This is Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young in for Tiziana Deering.
Some beneficial rain. We need all that we can get as moderate drought continues here about a quarter of eastern Massachusetts.
Thursday, you can see temperatures slowly continue to rise. We've got loads of sunshine in the forecast.
We're dialing up the heat for the end of the week. Friday is going to be more of that summertime touch, especially as you go away from the water. We're expecting the low 90s in many areas.
Prepare the next several days. It's going to get really dry as we lead up to some hotter temperatures.
Dry, hot, and sunny. According to the U.S. climate data, June in Boston is supposed to average a little less than 4 inches of rain. But as of this week, the Boston area is missing almost an inch and a half of rain. Cumulatively, since January 1st of this year, we're missing almost 5.6 inches of rain. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, nearly 75% of the Commonwealth is currently in a moderate drought. So what does all of this mean? With us now is Ann Carroll. She is the director of the Office of Water Resources in the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation. Ann, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So first of all, there is still water coming out of our taps and running through our rivers. So can you describe this for us? What does drought look like in Massachusetts to the average person?
Sure. So in very general terms, drought is just an abnormally dry condition. That's a shift away from what we average conditions are, what we normally expect for a prolonged period. And then, of course, Massachusetts defines it much more specifically than that through our drought plan, which I can talk a little bit more about. But right now, where we're at a, you know, sort of a level one and a level two drought across most of the state, so moderate to significant drought, it can be reflected both in terms of you might see lawns starting to brown, your garden might be wilting, the fire danger is elevated. If you look at the stream flow levels, they're low, they're pretty low.
So you're seeing water lines, I guess, in rivers and ponds.
Yes. So we have a network of gauges that tracks the stream flow and the groundwater levels across the state. And you can look at those, and essentially they're represented as dots on a map. So as you go from green being sort of normal to yellow and red, and right now you can see a lot of yellow, orange, and red showing up on the map.
Well, you've mentioned a lot of different names and labels for how we look at drought. So I want to talk about one that I've heard the most, you know, moderate drought, we've got significant drought. Can we talk about that scale and how it works?
Yes.
How does it go from bad to worse, and how high does that one go?
Okay, so the way we do it in Massachusetts is, and we basically follow a plan that was updated in 2019 after our significant drought of 2016. We split the state into 7 drought regions, and then there's 6 indicators that we look at and track. So there's a lot of data behind it. Then we have a task force that includes local, state, and federal partners and experts, including National Weather Service, USGS, that all deliberate looking at that data. So we take a look monthly at the two drivers of drought would be how much precipitation we're getting, but then also is it soaking into the ground or is it being evaporated? So evaporation and evapotranspiration. So those are kind of the two things that will shape what's happening. And then we're also looking at the response in the environment by looking at the stream flow levels, the groundwater levels, also the fire danger. There's an index that's calculated by the state fire districts, which is sort of about the soil moisture. And then lastly, another index that looks at looks at soil moisture.
One thing that I'm starting to think about, though, too, as we hit the hot summer months, is that it feels like we do see some drought or drier conditions in the summer. Is drought normal right now, I guess, is what I'm asking?
So it's a really good question. And we struggled with this when we updated our plan, because how do you define normal? So for some of the data that we have, I'll use rainfall, for example. We're very lucky in this state to have had dedicated people essentially tracking the rainfall every day, in some cases for over 100 years, and marking it down. So we have these great records. So when we redid our plan, we converted all of our data to percentiles. But what does that really mean? It just means is how rare is what we're seeing? Like, is this common or is this rare? So when you think about how much rainfall do we get every year, on average, what we put in our last report is it on average, Massachusetts gets about 48 inches, but that can vary. In a drought, in a severe drought year, it might be as low as 30, or it could be as high as 60. But what's been happening is that's been shifting as the climate has changed. And we now, this is no longer theoretical. We're living it. And we're seeing, we've experienced the evidence of more frequent droughts and also a concept called a flash drought, where you get a more rapid onset than we had come to expect or experience based on our history.
So it sounds like we might be expecting more droughts to come here in Massachusetts?
We certainly are expecting that, and we have been seeing that, and we're trying to do our best to prepare for that.
Ann Carroll is the director of the Office of Water Resources in the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation. Thanks, Ann.
You're welcome.
Eastern Massachusetts is at a level 2 significant drought, but it's not just the state that sets drought levels. Individual municipalities do as well. Danvers, Massachusetts has set their levels at level 4, where they've been since June 21st. Joining us now on the line to talk about how Danvers is dealing with its drought is Scott Souza. He is the field editor for Patch, covering Beverly, Danvers, Marblehead, Peabody, Salem, and Swampscott. Scott, hello, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on today, Carrie.
So, Scott, what have you seen? What does level 4 drought look like to you in these communities?
Well, up in Danvers, Danvers is part of the Ipswich River water basin, which is it's considered a kind of an endangered river because of two recent droughts over the last couple of years, over the last 6 years, two recent droughts, and you know, also stormwater and erosion. Because of that, a few years ago, the Department of Environmental Protection in Massachusetts, as part of the Waste Management Act, restricted Danvers and 13 other towns up in the North Shore, cities and towns up in the North Shore, of the amount of water that they can use during the watering seasons, which are the summer seasons. And Danvers is restricted to 3.8 million gallons of water per day, which sounds like a lot, but it doesn't go very far when you're trying to water lawns and fill swimming pools and do all the things that Danvers people like to do. So starting every year in May 1st, they kind of have this scale that ratchets up quickly in terms of restrictions, and they are already at level 4, which means that outdoor water use with sprinklers and whatnot can only be used 6 hours a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays between 7 and 10 p.m. I don't know how they came up with those particular hours. They seem random, but that is where they are current now. And then, you know, level 5 is next, which means that all outdoor garden watering can only be used by handheld hoses and cans, and you will no longer be able to wash your cars or fill your swimming pools.
I mean, that sounds like for the average person that's a lot to change or get used to. What have you heard from community members about how they're dealing with it?
You know, it's something that goes on every year, so I think it's just something that they deal with. I don't think there's a lot of, you know, fight back on it every year. It's just part of being part of the, you know, the Ipswich River basin. You know, I'm sure it's got to be frustrating with people in Danvers when they have, you know, drive through towns that aren't that far away that have a different water system, that have a little bit more liberal use and are able to take care of their lawns. But, you know, it's something that goes on every year. Last year they reached, this year they have reached level 4 earlier than usual. 2 years ago, or last year, we actually had a rainy July, so it actually let up a little bit in July. 2020 was the last time that they were at level 5, and I would expect, you know, given the weather forecast over the next week or so, that Danvers could be in what they call the conserve water level 5. And then level 6, which is the extreme drought conditions, there's no outdoor water use allowed at all.
Have you ever seen a level 6, or is that unheard of?
Well, the last time I came up with a level 6 was actually in 2012, but that had to do, they were rehabilitating a water treatment plant. So I don't know that they've, I don't remember them ever getting to a level 6 just based on dry weather conditions. But, you know, as I said, the Ipswich River has experienced two major droughts in the last 5 years. And the more it goes on, the, you know, theoretically, the worst it'll get every year. There was actually a consortium of beer companies up on the North Shore. There's a lot of breweries up on the North Shore, and Granite Coast, as part of the Endangered Ale series, actually brewed a beer called Hot Moon Kentucky Common that was with a special label that was done by a Marblehead artist named Amy Horahan that was actually designed to create more awareness for what's going on with the Ipswich River. And you can look up the Ipswich River Watershed Association for a lot more information on the difficulties that they have.
That's definitely one way to get people to pay attention to an issue. All right. Scott Souza is the Patch Field Editor covering Beverly, Danvers, Marblehead, Peabody, Salem, and Swampscott. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Okay, so what does all of this mean for you, the average person at home who just wants to water your home garden or take a nice cool shower after one of those 90-degree days that we've seen? With us to unpack what you need to know about living in a drought, we have Ian Cook with us in the studio. He is the executive director of the Neponset River Watershed Association. Hi, Ian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, we said earlier that cumulatively, starting from January 1st, Boston is missing more than 5 inches of rain. That just sounds like a lot. It did rain pretty hard earlier this week, and we did see some rain last night. I remember waking up and hearing it. Did that help us at all?
Certainly, we're happy to have any rain we can get. But, you know, in terms of the overall deficit we've had, it really didn't make a dent. We're really at the Blue Hill Observatory, which is the spot we usually look at because it's in the middle of our watershed. Rainfall for the year, even including what happened earlier this week, is about 25% below normal.
That sounds really significant when you put it in those numbers. What do you think folks need to know about living in a drought? What are average people going to notice as we continue down this path?
So I think you're going to see things be drier. If you're somebody who gets out and you know, recreates along rivers, which is a big priority for us, you're going to see some sections of rivers where maybe you'd like to go canoeing that just aren't going to have enough water to go canoeing anymore. Another thing we see is we do a lot of water quality monitoring around the watershed, and when it gets into drought conditions, water quality really deteriorates, and you start to see lots of impacts to wildlife. Fish and wildlife are adapted to deal with drought. I think one of the big challenges, especially in eastern Massachusetts, is there's a lot of people here, in addition to the wildlife. We like to use water, and that water comes from somewhere, and it comes out of the environment, which is part of why there's a push to conserve, because really what's happening to the rivers is there's a natural drought happening, but there's also active human water withdrawals that exacerbate that.
Now, I used to live in New Mexico and Arizona, and so I have this idea in my head of what really dry conditions look like, and I heard the word drought a lot out there. Does drought look different here in Massachusetts than it would in some of those more arid states?
Drought looks very different here in eastern Massachusetts. As my friend Ann said, you know, we normally get 48 inches of rain a year. Arizona probably gets 10 inches of rain a year. So it's a very different kind of environment, and we're adapted to very different water levels.
You are the head of the Neponset River Watershed Association. Can you speak specifically to how the Neponset River is doing right now? This river touches 10 different communities in 4 different neighborhoods in Boston.
That's right. The river is, it's not the worst it's ever been, but water levels in the river, before it rained on Monday, water levels in the river were about a third of normal. Which definitely means some of those recreational uses are definitely being curtailed. There's definitely some wildlife and water quality impacts. Things did pop up a little bit with the rain, but by the end of the weekend, we'll be back down to those levels.
I'm curious about farmers. We talked a little bit about wildlife and some of the water quality the impacts that the drought has on that. But when it comes to farmers who depend on rainfall and groundwater for their livelihood, do you know how this is affecting agriculture?
I am not an agriculture expert, but in Massachusetts, agricultural uses are considered an essential use. So in a drought, they're one of the last uses to get curtailed when we're trying to do water conservation.
I'm going to bring us back to my desert experience here for a little bit one more time. I remember, especially living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, we used to be able to get a rebate from the city if, you know, you did away with your grass and installed xeriscaping, which is essentially landscaping with drought-tolerant native plants. And, you know, you could imagine what a difference that makes. Is something like that in the cards for us here in Massachusetts, changing up the way we landscape our yards, that kind of thing?
I think that's a great idea. There are a few communities that they haven't quite gone as far as they have out west with, you know, paying you to to rip up your lawn. But there are a few communities who have done some really interesting things, trying to discourage a new development, creating very big lawns, because a lot of people, they buy a house, it's got an enormous lawn. You know, maybe the developer could just make the lawn a little smaller in the first place. But I don't know that we'll quite get to the lawn buybacks that you see in the West, but there definitely are a lot of things that communities can do to try to help reduce the demand for summer irrigation water, which is one of the biggest challenges when it comes to drought.
It does seem like there is a lot developers can do and what you can do on a community level. What about on an individual level to save water? What can folks do?
There's all kinds of things you can do. You know, a big one particularly related to drought is how you manage your landscaping. You know, to go to grass species that don't need to be irrigated, you can have a beautiful lawn that doesn't need to be irrigated, and lawn irrigation is a huge consumer. There's also all kinds of things you can do inside your home. I particularly like those because it's a matter of, you know, upgrading your gear, right? People buy a new phone every year, a new car every 5 years, but they're still using the same toilet that was installed in their house in 1972 that's using 4 gallons every time you flush. There's opportunities to really save money and water that way every day without even thinking about it. And a lot of communities offer rebates and incentives to try to encourage people to take advantage of those.
That's Ian Cook. He is the executive director of the Neponset River Watershed Association. Thanks so much for joining us. Slow internet. It's annoying in the best of times, and during COVID, with remote learning and working from home, it was even more obnoxious. Many people live in places with only one internet provider, so if the cost is high or the service is slow, you're kind of out of luck. According to a new report from the nonprofit Massachusetts Competitive Partnership, 34% of Massachusetts homes lack adequate broadband service. In some communities, like Springfield and Chelsea, that number is even higher than 50%. But across Massachusetts, about 50 towns are offering their own internet service in some way, in the hopes of expanding access and lowering costs. And more towns are moving to offer the services as well. Today on the show, we're talking with two local officials with two very different experiences and perspectives on municipal internet. Ian Kane is a city councilor with Quincy, where he is spearheading an effort to bring municipal internet to the town for more than 5 years. And Bill Bottigi is the general manager of the Braintree Electric Light Department, or BELD. That's the city utility. Braintree ran municipal internet for the city for 22 years before selling the service to Comcast last year. And also here with us is Evan Horowitz, the director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Evan, I'm going to start with you. For someone who might not be familiar with municipal internet, what exactly is it? Can you define it for us?
Well, actually, there are a couple of ways to define it, but the key thing is who's providing access to the internet? That is, do we have private companies that are laying wires and selling services, or do we have the city or town that you live in doing one or both of those things, either laying wires to houses or offering service packages? If you're doing one or two of those things, you could reasonably classify that as municipal broadband. How's that for a quick definition?
It's interesting. It's like one name for two kind of different definitions.
Actually, we probably could expand it from there. There's a whole suite of things that cities and towns can do between let's own all the wires and provide all the services and let's do nothing. And all those things deserve in some sense to fall under the umbrella of municipal broadband. We have one neighborhood where we're providing nice free Wi-Fi, or we have one package that we provide to low-income people. That also, I think, could be thought of as a public service.
And could you go into a little bit more what some of the reasons are that a city or a town might start to think about offering these kinds of services?
So, I mean, you highlighted the big one, which is people don't have ready access, lots of people. And you need to have ready access to participate in the modern economy and in modern life. So the key thing to understand, though, is at least in Massachusetts, the big problem is not, hey, are there enough wires to my house? The big problem is, do I have enough money to pay for service? That is, the reason that the bulk of those people who are struggling to access the internet or get broadband struggle is not because they don't have choices. It's because they don't have enough money to really readily afford service. So the most important thing the cities and towns can do is make it more affordable, as opposed to, I think a lot of people have in their heads, no, there aren't wires running to places. That's a problem like in the Texas Panhandle. It's a much smaller problem in Massachusetts.
So some of the communities that I've seen that are doing this, it includes Norwood, Shrewsbury. These aren't exactly low-income towns. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, almost every town has some pocket of low-income people, and that's really the big consideration, right? And we are talking about low-income. For residents of the Massachusetts, if you're earning $75,000 a year, that makes you pretty standard kind of middle-class family in Massachusetts. Odds are you've got broadband, over 95%. Right, 95% of those families have broadband. The people who are struggling are families earning less than $35,000. And in some towns, that's a lot of people. But in almost every town, that's some group of people. And the only real solution to getting them broadband is to meet them where they are and find a package that works for them. So in every town, you're going to have that group of people. And the town has the capacity to find them, to identify them, and to help them.
Do you see any trends coming up here? There were about 50 towns we mentioned, but is this growing? Is it kind of staying stagnant?
Well, this has cycled over time. You know, there was a big push probably going back 20 years when a lot of these, I just keep calling them wires just because I don't want to get the details, but like when a lot of the wires were being put down into people's homes and the towns are saying, actually, they're not going everywhere. There are not enough people. So there was a push kind of 20 years ago to say, well, we need to do more to get the wires. And then it kind of went away and became sort of more of a private thing. But then more recently, there's been this recognition that actually poverty is a big problem and the towns have a role to play there. So there's been a renewed interest in municipal involvement in the broadband space, chiefly around this issue of affordability, equity, and access.
I want to turn to two of our officials who are with us in the studio now, too, to talk about their towns. Bill, I'm going to start with you. Why did Braintree start offering municipal internet more than 22 years ago?
Back in the late 1990s, there was only one provider in town. It was the precursor to Comcast, Time Warner, and they offered only cable TV. So the town came to Braintree Electric and asked us if we'd start offering high-speed internet. So we started with high-speed internet. That's how we got into the business. We had the network installed to do remote meter reading, and it was a good match for high-speed internet.
Again, we are talking about municipal internet with Bill Botigi, who is the general manager of the Braintree Electric Light Department. Ian Kane is also with us in studio, who's the city councilor, or who is a city councilor in Quincy, and Evan Horowitz, the director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Ian, the next question is for you. A lot of the thinking around municipal internet was because of COVID, when we all needed to do more stuff online and at home. But you were thinking about this in 2016, pre-pandemic, by a lot. So what was happening that made you want to pursue this?
So when I first campaigned for office in 2015, this was by far the number one issue that people brought to my attention, was a lack of options for internet service providers. I think people have been fed up with the incumbent service quality as well as the price, which don't match. And so over time, I saw that I knew about Braintree, but I saw that Milton, the town next over from Quincy, was looking into developing a municipal broadband system. And so I said, why don't we do this? You know, this is a sort of a problem that we have. Residents are looking for a solution. So why don't we try to identify if we can make this happen?
Before we go too much further into the conversation, I do want to clarify again the differences between these two towns and what you're doing. Both of them do fall under that municipal internet label like we were talking about earlier, but there are different ways to do this, as we mentioned. Braintree is basically running its own internet company. Is that right?
Until recently. We recently actually sold the business.
And Quincy, you are running the lines.
We intend to run the lines. Yeah, we intend to build the backbone or the infrastructure that would support competition for internet service providers to offer their service to residents.
Okay, so Bill, can you go into a little bit more why Braintree got out of the business?
Sure. Our infrastructure was built over 20 years ago, probably 30-year-old technology. We went through the entire life cycle of the business. We started with internet, added cable TV, added telephone. Back in the mid-2000s, 2007 or so, we were competing with Comcast when Verizon Fios decided to enter the business in Braintree also. So now there's three providers, so lots of competition. The other extreme from what a lot of towns are experiencing.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds great for prices.
Right, it did help with prices. You know, we, in the end, were offering high-speed internet for $39 a month, very robust bandwidth. With that competition that Fios brought into town, it woke up Comcast, and they started marketing very aggressively in the town of Braintree, door-to-door salesmen, lots of free offerings. And we fought the good fight for about 12 years when we got to the point where we were going to have to make a major investment into our infrastructure, $5 to $7 million to upgrade it. We were down to about 2,500 customers, even though we're the hometown provider, with our offering, and we decided to exit the business instead of spending that, say, $7 million to keep 2,500 customers going.
Was it something that was making the city money, or how? What's that financial picture look like?
We ran it as a break-even business, so we would set our rates to pay our bills and set the rates high enough to invest in small infrastructure improvements because we had to keep up with the speeds, and HDTV came along and DVRs came along and all the bells and whistles that people want. And we were able to compete, but couldn't convince people to switch to Braintree Electric. And we don't have the marketing budget, to be frankly with you, that the other towns do. Other companies do. I'm sorry.
No, that makes sense. Evan, I do want to turn back to you for the next question. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on Braintree's decision to sell their municipal internet service.
Well, I mean, the way it's being laid out here, I think it makes good sense. That is, you're providing a service that very few of the people in your town are using, and you're not doing it to generate revenue for the town, and you've created a market where there's some relatively robust competition. Then you could think, well, what are we doing this for? What is it? What is the goal here? What's the mission? And I think that's the question, really, that towns have to ask themselves. If we want to get into the municipal broadband space, what are we trying to accomplish? Are we trying to provide a service to residents? Are we trying to increase competition? And, you know, I think the numbers suggest that the main thing towns should be thinking about is, how do we get to universal broadband? That is, what we can do is fill gaps in this market, because there are gaps in this market, and a big part of it has to do with affordability. And that's a mission that towns have to take up, because even if you have three or four, you know, providers competing, they're going to struggle to serve the lowest income families in any given town. It just doesn't pay for them. And that's a role, that's a place where towns and cities can really step in and make a difference.
Ian, I'm going to turn back to you now. As a city councilor in Quincy, does it worry you to see Braintree run into investment challenges like this? Do you think that you might run into the same thing?
No, that's my short answer. You know, I love Braintree, neighboring town. We were once a part of the same unit back in the 1800s. But I think, you know, for us as a local elected official, we're trying to provide the best services for that the municipality can offer for our residents. And so, you know, we're looking at this in a number of ways. And I think that you started to allude to the fact that, yes, we looked at this before COVID, and COVID brought a whole host of different reasons and a rationale for why we should do this. People were working from home. People are educating from home. Bandwidth capacities. The incumbents raised data caps and started charging more, which was ridiculous. And then there was a larger conversation that started to take place around equity. And people started to realize that digital equity is a huge component of this equity discussion that we should be having, that allow people to adequately have access to the digital economy, to workforce, to education that they didn't. People having to go to fast food restaurants in order to get adequate Wi-Fi, right, to perform their work and to do their schoolwork. People using the library, which is a great resource that we have also. But you know, from our perspective, this is a resident-driven, community-driven project that, you know, we put out a survey to the residents of our city with our city census a couple of years ago, and we got over 10,000 paper responses back through the mail, and 80% of those responses were overwhelmingly favorable. So, you know, we're moving forward because this is being driven by the residents of the city, and we're confident that this model, which, you know, we started looking at 4 or 5 years ago, is something that can be a model for other cities and towns to replicate.
Ian, I'm also wondering, there are several other towns that are moving towards or thinking about municipal internet. Wayland, Milton, near you, but also Cambridge and Falmouth, and there's a couple others too. Why do you think there's an increased interest in municipal internet?
Again, quick answer, there's resources available. There's money. So
is that because of COVID?
It is because of COVID. There was an infrastructure bill, and then there was a larger bill. So there's a Digital Equity Act, and there was a Broadband Equity Access and Deployment program that were both launched, but there was the infrastructure bill as well. And then that availed capital to be deployed through states, and then from those states through cities and towns. And I think there's a couple of, at first when the infrastructure bill came out, there was, guidance that was released from the U.S. Treasury that was more or less trying to limit the way that people could, cities and towns could spend. Cities and towns needed to have a certain low level of broadband capacity, right? And if it met that threshold, then you couldn't use that to deploy capital for infrastructure. And so now we're seeing next level guidance come from the FCC. And I know that we're still waiting to hear on how some of that capital can be spent. But I know that there is a big push to use for low and moderate income families, public housing, very unique concepts that would change the game for people that don't have digital access. But those cities and towns that you mentioned, we're all in touch, and we're, you know, sharing best practices. And you know, to that end, we are actually establishing what's called the Massachusetts Digital Infrastructure Consortium in order to advocate for these money to be properly spent in order to support universal access to digital infrastructure.
Bill, I want to turn to you now. I mean, hearing about a lot of these resources that are coming out, the investment that the federal and state government is making, does that give you guys second thoughts about getting out of the business? Or was it really just, the replacement factor was getting so expensive?
Because of the cost of the replacement and the existing competition in town, it still makes sense to me that we got out of the business. There's so many choices available to the residents. 5G is coming also, which is going to allow wireless connectivity in the home. Starlink is another, that low Earth satellite offering. So there's lots of ways of getting high-speed internet now. So we just thought it was best to be cautious and not make that major investment.
And Ian, what are the next steps for Quincy? Can you tell me a little bit more about the future that you're looking at?
Absolutely. So we put together a master plan at the end of 2020, and there's a couple of legal steps that needed to be taken. So there needs to be a municipal light plant that's established, which will govern the infrastructure itself. And so the city council just passed an ordinance within the last 2 months, which is the first process of two votes that need to be taken in sequential sessions. So we took the first vote, we'll take the second vote in the fall, and then it needs to go to the public for a vote to form the municipal light plant, which we'll have on the ballot, hopefully, by September. At the same time, we've engaged an engineering and consulting firm who are identifying areas for pilot projects. So we've identified two areas in the city that would be adequate. They're socially and economically diverse and would make for good use of sort of a pilot project to understand how this is going to work, what construction looks like. So we're hoping to start work on that project in the next year.
And my last question goes to Evan. I want to talk about security concerns potentially with municipal internet. Is that something consumers, residents should be concerned about when it comes to getting your internet service from your city?
I can't imagine having higher security concerns for my city or, you know, publicly controlled city or town than I have for private companies with, let's say, not always transparent information about the security and data usage. So, I mean, I don't think of it as a high level issue. I mean, there are a couple things I did want to say. One is to kind of put a little meat on the bones of the digital equity side of things. We're doing some work in another part of the state, so I'll say that it's not exactly in the Braintree-Quincy area. But in Essex County, we found, for instance, that non-white families earning $100,000 a year have lower rates of broadband access than white families earning $50,000 a year. So this is a real thing, and it is not purely a proxy for dollars, and it needs some kind of direct attention. So thinking about what towns and cities can do makes sense. I will say, like, a little less convinced that laying wires is the best way to do it. The federal government is also doing things like just providing subsidies for people to buy into existing programs. That's been a major push from them and a quite successful one. And I think cities and towns would do well to think about the full range of options between laying wire and doing nothing, such as providing subsidies, doing more public Wi-Fi, identifying tracts or neighborhoods where they can really make the most impactful interventions.
That was Evan Horowitz, director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Also with us was Bill Buttigieg of the Braintree Electric Light Department and Ian Kane, Quincy City Councilor. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
In today's installment of Tech Talk, where we tackle the latest news in technology, we're getting deep into a piece of Americana. A Ford truck that has been the most popular car in the U.S. for about 40 years and a fixture of American pop culture is going electric. Then I see an F-150 and all the memories you just hit me. You're driving right through my mind and every time I think I'm fine. I see the headlights of an F-150. That is just one of many odes to the popular pickup truck by Robin Ottolini. Ford's new F-150 Lightning is the legacy auto company's effort to take a beloved formula and make it electric and battery powered. And they're not the only ones. Many car manufacturers are scrambling to jump into the electric vehicle market, which is currently dominated by Texas-based company Tesla, which holds about 70% of the market. Here in the Commonwealth, we are far from meeting our 2030 emission goals. So can this new vehicle, an electric pickup truck, realistically win drivers over in Massachusetts? Here to tell us more about his recent test drive of the F-150 Lightning is Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe, and he is joining us for this week's Tech Talk. Hi.
Hey, glad to be here.
Very glad you're joining us to tell us all about your test drive. Was it fun? What happened?
Oh, it was incredibly fun. I mean, look, I like electric cars to begin with. I've driven Teslas and all kinds of other vehicles like this. I think they are innately some of the most entertaining things you could ever drive, and especially when you've got a 563-horsepower pickup truck that's entirely electric. It's like riding in a spaceship. It is absolutely delightful, and yet I still have my reservations about it as a truck. As a vehicle, it's insanely cool. It was one of the most pleasant driving experiences I've ever had. You're sitting in this vehicle. It's like being in your living room. It is the quietest thing. I mean, it's a truck, and it's the quietest thing I've ever ridden in my life. It has an amazingly soft, gentle ride, and of course, it has the insane acceleration that you expect from any electric vehicle. It's absolutely a magical vehicle. My reservations are almost entirely about this whole issue of battery life and endurance and whether you can deal with that in the context of an everyday work vehicle. If you're somebody who uses a truck for like entertainment or like camping or things like that, I think this is a pretty darn good choice. If you're using it to do construction work or plumbing or something like that, it might be if you're not driving very far. If you are, this could be a problem.
Well, take us on your route a little bit. What towns did you go through? Did you go on the interstate and rural roads?
Well, I didn't have just one route. I'd just get in and drive. I'd go to Providence or I'd go to Braintree or I'd go to Boston and back and so forth, just to get a feel for what was going on and also to sample the available accessibility of charging stations. I got a tip from one guy that was kind of cool, and it makes perfect sense if you think about it. You know where they got free electric car charging? The casino. Yeah. The casino, they got it. It's right down there in the basement parking lot, and it makes perfect sense. They got the chargers. They're sitting right next to the elevator. You pull up, you put in your car, and then you get out, walk into the elevator, and you're surrounded by these slot machines. And it's like, you know, it's a total casino, and you can see the logic of it. These are what are known as level 2 chargers. They are basically connected to a 240-volt connection like the one you use at a dryer at home. And the problem with a level 2 charger is that it's going to take you hours to get a really substantial charge on the car. And that makes it perfect for a casino because they get you up in there and they get you gambling. But that's one of the key limitations, especially when you're dealing with something like a truck, where if it's carrying a heavy load, you're going to have a substantial drain on the battery. One of the things I did was attach a 2,000-pound U-Haul trailer. I didn't have anything to carry.
I was just going to ask if you towed anything, because that's what people get a pickup truck for.
Absolutely. I mean, Ford didn't give me the little ball thing that goes. I had to go to.
You had to get your own tailgate.
The trailer hitch is there.
The trailer hitch, yes.
Yeah, I just had to go get the little ball thing, and I plugged it in there, and then went and got the U-Haul trailer. The battery listing, it said I had about 220 miles of range left before. As soon as I hooked it up, it recalculated and says, carrying this load, you only have about 100 miles of range left. And that's towing 2,000 pounds with nothing in the trailer. If this thing is rated for 7,500 pounds of towing. If you really filled it up, the load on the battery begins to become really substantial. Now, if you do the kind of work where you're not driving a lot of miles every day, that might not be a problem. If you're driving substantial amounts of miles with heavy loads, you got a problem here.
Was there any place in Massachusetts? You mentioned the level two chargers. Right. They take forever. What about, was there a place that had a lot of level three or even any?
Well, not a lot of level three, but yes, there are places. You know, it's kind of interesting. There actually are a fair number of chargers out there now, if you know where to look for them. And, you know, they have all these special apps. And I didn't mention this in my story, but one of the challenges is different companies that run chargers have different policies. For example, in some cases, you have to download their app and sign up in order to use their charger. In other cases, you can just drive up, whip out a credit card, and use the charger. So it can be really confusing. Another major problem, almost none of these chargers have signs. It is the weirdest thing. You know, you're driving down the road, you're looking for gasoline, they got signs everywhere, gasoline, gasoline. There's almost nothing like that for chargers. There was one I found out in Brockton. I drove past it three times before I figured out it was a car charging site, because the chargers themselves are tiny. They aren't very large. And if you don't know exactly where they are, you can't find them. They need to put up signs around these things. But last but not least, level three. This is extremely important. I plugged in this truck at about 40% power, and me and my son, we were in Providence, and we pulled into a Walmart parking lot, and there we saw it glowing in the distance, a sign that read Electrify America. This is important. Electrify America is run by Volkswagen. Remember how they had to pay billions of dollars to make up for lying about how their cars performed on diesel emissions tests? The settlement involved them having to build level three car chargers. They set up a company to do it called Electrify America, and they work great. You plug the truck in. Half an hour later, I went from 40% battery to 83% battery while I was in the Walmart just wandering around. That was really good performance there. And if you could recharge electric cars that quickly, then they suddenly become a much more practical option. But level three chargers are very rare right now. They are very hard to find. There's a new study out from the Edison Electric Institute. They are predicting, based on current proposals, that by the year 2030, there will only be about 40,000, 45,000 level three chargers in the entire United States. But they say the market is going to need 140,000 of them to really cover the country. Just by comparison, by the way, there are 145,000 gas stations in the U.S., just so you have a rough idea. So you need roughly that many level three chargers before this really becomes practical. And we're nowhere near that. And that's a huge problem.
So it sounds like it's a ways off before a lot more people are going to be rushing to get these cars, even the more iconic F-150.
Oh, the electric ones? No, look, these things are marvelous. I mean, this is just such a wonderful vehicle, but it's a chicken-egg thing. I got to throw in one more thing. There's this fascinating thing called demand charge. If you use an electric component, it's almost never used. It's almost entirely commercial industrial. If you do anything commercial or industrial that requires a huge surge of power, the electric company adds on this charge that can run into thousands of dollars called a demand charge to cover the need to pay for all the power plants and cables and everything to provide that much juice. Right now, there are so few electric cars on the road that if you spend all the money to set up a level three charger and then you have to pay that demand charge every month, you haven't got a chance of paying back the cost of putting in a level three charger. Once there are a lot of cars on the road, this demand charge problem goes away. But there aren't enough yet. And so all these companies are saying, I'm not going to put a level three charger in until there are more people on the road to use a level three charger. And we've got to figure out how to solve that problem.
It sounds like, you know, it's almost just as expensive to buy the very expensive gas we have out there right now. How do those numbers add up? Do you know?
Well, no, actually, it was interesting because on the level three charger, when I went from 40 to 83%, and I forget how many of those I had, it must have been like 100 or some miles. Electrify America has a deal with Ford, so I didn't have to pay. But they told me how much it would have come to, and it was about $25. And No, actually, that was about comparable to a gasoline car, today's gasoline prices, I thought. But no, if you're doing, for example, a level two, as I understand, it would be substantially cheaper than gasoline, but the time it takes to charge is a lot longer. So the problem is mainly that it takes forever to find a way to recharge your car. And millions of people, of course, you have to keep in mind, do not live in single-family homes and don't have a place where they can set up their own charger and then connect it to their vehicle. So there are all these things compiled together that are making this a pretty expensive proposition.
Well, it sounds like you learned a lot from this experience.
Oh, yeah.
And even managed to have some fun.
Absolutely.
I do want to turn now to a little bit more pressing news of the day as well. We have spoken previously with you about privacy concerns with location data and the implications should the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade come to pass. Well, this law now has become reality. Can you remind listeners particularly of the privacy issues that you are worried about?
Well, no, this is about not just abortion at all. This is about abortion pushed the button that made people really start thinking, holy crap, there are all these devices I use every day that are tracking everything I do. They could be used to investigate me for abortion or countless other things. And it may finally be getting people off the dime to think about the need for some kind of a national privacy policy. And by the way, there's all kinds of stuff since I last talked about it. There's a great story that appeared in today's Washington Post about the fact that there's a calendaring app that Planned Parenthood uses, where you go in to sign up for an appointment to Planned Parenthood. An investigator found out that if you use that app, it's collecting your IP information, which could be used to find out where you are and who you are, and then giving it, or selling it rather, to Facebook and Google and other companies. So Planned Parenthood, you go in, you sign up, you're supposed to be signing up for some kind of a treatment, and they are able to, the people who are signing you up are sending the data about who you are to another company, and you don't even know what's going on. And that's just one example of how personal information about any of us is constantly being collected by all kinds of devices. We don't even realize it. I'm just about go back to the truck. Do you know that every time somebody else got in that truck with me, it knows? This has become common on modern cars. The car automatically detects whether there are other people in the car with you. So now that car knows where you are, what time you're there, and how many people are in the vehicle with you. And they can give that information to the police, they can give it to marketers, etc. I bring that up because I want to show that this is not just about the controversy of abortion. We are surrounded by devices that are constantly collecting data about us, and most of us do not know.
Because we have such a short time left, what are some specific policies that might be in the works or that tech companies can do to protect people seeking abortions?
Well, there are endless things that you can do to try to control your personal data. Some people are calling for example, there's the attempt to persuade Google to stop keeping records of where you go. Google could say, we are no longer going to store that information. Google and Apple have been asked to change their app policies so that the apps that collect this information will no longer be allowed to do so. Obviously, there's movement afoot to try to pass a national privacy law that would give us the right to tell companies, you can't collect this information.
And I can't wait to hear more about that with you later. That's Hiawatha Bray with the Boston Globe. Thank you, Hiawatha.
Oh, thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Carrie Young. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.